The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
I believe we're here to talk about happiness, raising happy children. I think that presupposes a realization that happiness must be important, because I'm sure you people have more important things to do, maybe even things that would make you more happy to discuss or to indulge in this evening and to come out for this. So I guess we've come to the realization that happiness is very significant. But I think we have some problems with happiness. You know, everybody is pursuing happiness. In fact, it's one of the inalienable rights of American citizens, the pursuit of happiness. And yet, many people don't seem to find it. In fact, it probably is one of the most elusive states of being, commodities, items for which we search and crave and strive for, maybe even more than anything else. The question is why? Why is it so difficult? Why, in a world which offers so much in the way of pleasure, opportunities to have fun, to indulge ourselves, to enjoy ourselves, we have more means of pleasure in society today than ever before in all of history, probably put together. I don't know this community that well, but I often travel to what I consider the two fun capitals of the world, Florida and California, and nobody's happy. In fact, I think you people look a lot happier to me over here than maybe a lot of those people. But why is it so elusive? Why is it so difficult? And it occurred to me a while ago that maybe the reason is that nobody knows what happiness is. If you don't know what you're looking for, you're not going to be too successful at finding it. What is happiness? Many people in our society believe that happiness is the feeling that you have when you indulge in pleasure. And if you think that I'm exaggerating, ask your children. Maybe not your children, ask your neighbor's children. So many kids today honestly believe that they will find happiness in another game, in another pleasure, in another stimulation, in another drink, in another, I don't know what problems you got in this community, but if you don't have the problems yet, don't be so smug, because they're all around and they're invading all of our lives eventually. But that's what they believe. Just keep up the pleasure, and we'll be happy. The problem is, if you ask them at any given moment, are they happy? They're not sure. Of course, they don't know what it is, but they know what it's not. And they seem to sense that they're just not happy with everything that they have. In fact, I think that one of the reasons that we have less happiness today than ever before in history is because we have more pleasure. Now, how does that work? I think it's very simple. Because when you don't have a lot of sources of pleasure, you dream about the pleasure that you're eventually going to have, and you know, of course I'm not happy yet because I'm not there yet, but I'm going to get there. You know, in the previous generation, it used to take about 60 years till you make it in the world. So for the first 60 years, you're building your business, you're building your family, you're establishing yourself, you haven't made it yet. So you're not happy, but who cares? Like, you're not supposed to be. What happened then when you get 61, 62, 63, you know, it starts over here, and the pain and this, and you know how, I mean, you don't know, you should know, but everybody eventually knows from it. And now already, who could be happy? It's already, shenente vivite, you know what that means? I'm already close to the other side. Today, teenagers have more opportunities for pleasure than their parents and grandparents ever had. They've done that. They've been there. They've done that. By the time you're 16, you've experienced everything. And if you don't think it's true, ask your kids in a moment of honesty, and they'll tell you about their friends. But Now what? So now I know when I'm 16. I don't have to wait till I'm 60 to realize that it's not doing it for me. Pleasure doesn't seem to be equated to happiness. It doesn't seem to bring happiness. In fact, it leaves with it a void that defies that ever feeling of true happiness. Because I've indulged, I've enjoyed, I was ecstatic, I had a blast, and right now I'm back where I started from, in fact, a little bit worse. And, you know, it really gets a little bit more complicated even than that. You know, I used to tell a story about the first time I visited Sarah's restaurant in Miami. And it was a dairy restaurant. And I was introduced there to a drink many years ago, pina colada. You know, I never really was into drinking, and I didn't know what this pina colada was about. But I was introduced to this pina colada, and I liked it. It was very good. So my wife, at the next simcha that we were at, she asked me, you know, maybe you want to order a pina colada. I mean, she's a good lady. I mean, she's not a bad influence, don't worry. But anyway, she said, maybe you want to order. I said, yeah, try a pina colada. Nobody makes pina colada like Sarah's. And another simcha a couple months later, maybe you want to try a pina colada? Yeah, I'd like to try. Even I remember on my own, I think, by then. And nobody makes pina colada like Sarah's. About 2-3 years later, I had the opportunity to be in Sarah's again. And of course, the first thing, I didn't even look at the menu, just order pina colada. Then I realized that Sarah doesn't know how to make pina colada. What happened? And I realized it was very simple. The first time you indulge in any type of a physical pleasure, has a good sensation, it feels good. What happens the next time is, the second time around, the sensation, the sensitivity has been dulled because I experienced the pleasure already. So I need more stimulus to bring me to the same level of pleasure. Not only that, the mind works in the opposite way. Our mind exaggerates the pleasures of the past. So in my mind, I have exaggerated the pleasure over the months to think that it was even greater than it was. And now I compete with a dull sensitivity and a new pleasure, which can't compete because I've already had it once. So I end up with such a disparity, there's no pleasure. It's just frustration. And this is the frustration that our kids feel. This is the frustration that we too feel if we allow ourselves to pay attention in the pursuit and the indulgence in pleasure as the road to the achievement of happiness. We never seem to make it. And I have a theory I'd like to share with you. I don't want anyone here to believe that that this really happened. I mean, I don't mind if you believe that it happened, but you know, it didn't. Anyway, but I have a theory. And my theory goes something like this. About 150 years ago, there was a Jewish entrepreneur, and I'll let you guess his name. He came up with a brilliant idea, how to make megabucks. And he went over to a friend of his who was a scientist, and he said to him as follows, if you can come up with a theory that can turn mankind into one big accident, then we can cash in, and we have money for life. Of course, his friend came up with a good theory to turn mankind into an accident. That was the theory of evolution. We're all here, a bunch of accidents. No creation. First time in all of human history that masses of people began to consider the possibility that they were here by accident. Well, I believe, well, let's get to the fact that it's no accident at what the results happened, but what happened? This guy who came up with this brilliant idea said, if mankind begins to believe, begins to feel that he and she, that we are the results of accidents, an accident, by definition, has no purpose. If mankind has no purpose, they'll be miserable, depressed. If people are depressed, we'll psychiatrize them and psychologize them and medicate them, and that's it. We'll cash in. And of course, you can guess who these two, you know, the scientists, you know. And who's the entrepreneur? Come on.
Freud.
Of course, it never happened, as I told you. But it was a brilliant idea. Because the moment that you divest humanity of a sense of purpose, you generate massive depression. And I'd like to try to explain why, and maybe put this whole system and idea of human happiness into a different perspective. You know, we're very fortunate people. The world is constantly attempting to discover the realities of human existence. We have the blueprint by which the world was created. Our rabbis in the Medrash tell us that the Almighty looked into his Torah and based on that blueprint created the world. So the Torah carries within it the secrets of creation. The understanding of the human nature, the understanding of all of the dynamics of human existence, of universal existence, of historical existence, it's all in our Torah. One of the secrets that we have is a language. We have a language, the Loshon HaKodesh. That's the language of the Holy One, the language of HaKodesh Baruch Hu. Not modern Hebrew. Modern Hebrew is a takeoff of Loshon HaKodesh, but this is the biblical language itself. In Loshon HaKodesh, as distinct from every other language on the face of this earth, there is a system that goes as follows. The three-letter root, the shoresh, the three-letter root of a word describes the essence of the concept. It isn't arbitrary. In all languages, if this is called a chair, it's not because it's cherry. It's just an agreement that people have agreed to call this a chair. And if this is called, I'm not quite sure what this contraption is called, but whatever it's called, it's just a call that way because some people decided to call it that way. But there's nothing significant in its name. Not so in the Loshon HaKodesh. When the three-letter root of a word appears, it always represents implanting into that word the significance of the essence of the concept. What's the Loshon HaKodesh word for happiness? It has many forms of happiness, that's true. But in Loshon HaKodesh, one of the highest forms of happiness is Osher. Osher spelled with an Aleph. Ashrei Yoshvei Beisecho. David HaMelech said, Achas Shoalti Meis Hashem Oiso Avakesh Shivti Beis Hashem. He had one request, to sit in the house of Hashem and to bask in the countenance of the Divine Presence. Ashrei Yoshvei Beisecho. Happy is the one who sits in the house of Hashem. The shoresh of that word, Osher, seems to be from Yishur, Le'asher, to validate. Happiness is about feeling validated. Happiness is about self-worth. Happiness is about feeling good about myself. If a person is valid, if a person feels validated, then he's happy. And for validation, it's a whole different system than for the pursuit of pleasure. In fact, when I need outward, external stimuli to make me happy, that's extremely invalid. I hear this from the kids, again, not your kids, Baruch Hashem, but I hear this from the kids all the time. I have no life. I'm trash. What do you mean, trash? Well, you get trashed all the time. Why should you be trash? You're having a good time. You're having a blast. No, but I need external things to make me feel temporarily good. That means I have nothing inside. It's not me. I guess I coined the phrase, I don't know if anyone ever said, I'm chemically happy. What means to be chemically happy? Very sad. Very sad state of happiness. Chemically happy. That's it. I need outside stimuli to make me happy. It's not my validation. It's invalidation because in and of myself, I have nothing. I have no worth. And I need all of this stuff from the outside to make me feel temporarily good, even though it doesn't last. And I think that if we have this concept, it makes it a lot easier to understand what we have to do to to be happy, and what we have to do to inspire and engender and guide and help our children to find this happiness as well. It's about feeling good about themselves. Now, not just good about myself, but valid, worthy. What makes a person feel most validated? Most validated. Well, I would suggest to you that probably more than anything else, it's a sense of purpose, right? I have purpose in life. I have a purpose. So a purpose means, and that's two parts to it, I have a purpose, and I'm fulfilling my purpose. That's it. I'm great. I have a purpose, and I'm constantly involved in the pursuit and in the fulfillment of that purpose. Wow, I should feel great about myself. Well, I want to share with you the real purpose of my visit here this evening. I'm involved with an organization that has dedicated time, effort, fundraising efforts as well, to save a almost extinct species of cockroach that roams the Delaware Valley. What are you laughing about? That's really the reason I'm here this evening. That's the fact I'm going to make an appeal in a few minutes. Okay? This is a very, very beautiful bug, and it's on the verge of extinction, because a lot of you people, when you see it, you just go like this. And my job is, I've dedicated my life to saving this strain of cockroach from extinction. Now, I have a purpose. And I want you to know I raised already $4 million for this purpose. I should feel pretty good about myself. I have purpose. I have success in the accomplishment, the achievement, the pursuit, the fulfillment of my purpose. Why doesn't that make me happy? And it doesn't. Why? What's wrong? What's missing? What's missing? Purpose is the ingredient. Purpose makes you feel good about yourself. If you have purpose, you feel good. And if you fulfill the purpose, you feel even better. And if you raise $3-4 million, you got to feel good about yourself. Except it's a not-for-profit organization, so I can't spend the money for myself. I have to use it for cockroaches. What's missing? You know what's missing? I'll tell you what's missing. When I go to sleep at night and I start to think about my day and how purposeful and meaningful it was and how validated I feel, I say, that's the purpose for a nice Jewish boy. I say, that's the purpose. I got a little brain, not too much, you know what I mean, but a little something I got up there. That's the best use of what I got. I got some fundraising skills as well, you know, over the years. I've raised a couple of bucks. That's And then I stopped to think and I said, where did this purpose come from? Who made it up? Well, how do I know that's my purpose? Well, I decided one day arbitrarily that that's my purpose. Great. So I was able to fool myself for a little bit of time. But it wasn't real. It wasn't genuine. There was something incongruous about that purpose. When I looked in the mirror and I saw what I thought, what I hoped, what I fooled myself to think was something of capability and of potential, and I realized that it was all about saving cockroaches, I was devastated. So the answer is not just any purpose. The answer is knowing my purpose. The answer is finding a purpose which is appropriate to a human being gifted with the gifts of life, with the talents, with the insight, with the sensitivity, with the intelligence that we have. And if we do not have a means of discovering that purpose, we're lacking. We're lacking, we'll be missing so much. How do we go about discovering that purpose? Well, maybe by inverse reasoning, if we analyze our friend, the deal that was made between Darwin and Freud, we could begin to understand how it works. Because what did they do? They said, hey, we're going to make man into an accident. We're going to exit the creator from the formula. That means that there's no creator, it's all an accident, there's no purpose. Now, how do we best know? I look at this array of technology that it's a little bit hidden from you people over here, but there's an array of technology over here in front of you. I'd like to know, how do I find out what its purpose is? How do I know? It's only one way.
You ask its creator.
Ask its creator. And the creator usually sends the technology with a book of directions, with a handbook, you know, with instructions. If we could communicate with the creator and ask him to please email us the book of instructions, and we could figure out for what purpose we were created, we'd have the secret to true happiness. That's what it's about. Purpose is the most validating formula that exists in all of human existence. True purpose is the only thing that truly validates us. True purpose can only be given to us by the one who created us in the first place. And if he won't speak directly with us, we need some type of communication from him to us, which gives us the clear statement of what this is for and how you use it. And that's where I believe that we, all of us, are positioned in a very unique position to achieve in our own lives and to inspire in our children's lives true happiness. Despite the fact that we are living and they are growing up in a world which offers so many sophisticated deterrents to happiness, because it's a society that is built upon that sense that there is nothing inside and everything has to come from without to give me that pleasure, to give me that peace of mind, to give me that temporary satisfaction. We are uniquely positioned to substitute for those temporal pleasures which ultimately lead our children and ourselves to frustration, for something that's true, for something that's meaningful, for something that's real, for something that's lasting. Why are we in such a position? Well, we have a claim that no other nation in the world has ever dared to claim. Very bizarre thing if you think about history. You know, Judaism goes back thousands of years, predates the major religions of the world today significantly. Major religions have attempted over the years, over the millennia, to copy from Judaism. We have a Shabbos. Well, some of the religions have decided to move it to Friday. Some move it to Sunday. I don't know anyone who moved it to Tuesday. They don't dare to get too far away from us, you know. But they're copying. They copy so much. So many of the concepts, the values. In fact, in the world today, it's even known as the Judeo-Christian ethic. Imagine that all of human society admits that the basic ethic with which civilization functions, upon which civilization today is built, is the Judeo, not Christian Judeo, but Judeo-Christian ethic. Now, these are not our friends that are admitting to this, but these are the facts of life. They've taken so much from us. You see on a couple of months from now, you see they come out of church some Sunday, in April or something, with a palm thing, you know, Palm Sunday. Where do you think they got it from? They got it from the Lulav. The only thing is they made one mistake. They don't have an oral Torah. They don't have a Torah Shabbat Peh. So they don't know how to read the written law. It says, Ulekachtem lochem bayom horishon. You should take on the first day. It means the first day of the holiday. They thought it means Yom HaRishon, which means Sunday. So they take it on Sunday. But they copy. There's one claim. There's one winning claim. There's one fundamental concept, which is the pillar of Judaism and the foundation of human happiness, which everyone pursues and attempts to achieve. And that they didn't dare to copy. And that is that Judaism states its acceptance, its realization, its belief, its knowledge, its evidence, and the testimony that we have from generation to generation, that the Creator himself appeared publicly to the entire Jewish nation, some few million souls, and spoke directly to them, and spoke directly in the earshot of this entire nation to Moshe Rabbeinu, to the leader, to the prophet, and authorized him to communicate with them on his behalf. Millions of eyewitnesses saw, heard. This is what we call Maimon Har Sinai. This is the revelation at Sinai. No other religion, with all that they've copied from Judaism, has ever dared to make such a claim. Why not? Very bizarre. We made it first. Not only that, the claims that they do make, what are the claims they make? They say, oh, God appeared to me privately. God appeared to me privately. That's what the Mormons, what's his name, John Smith or Joe Smith, or I always forget which Smith it is. So one of the Smith brothers, that you know, in a hotel room up in upstate New York, the angel Moroni came to him and told him, go start this new faith. The same thing we have, that was Jesus' claim, and that was Muhammad's claim. Muhammad made the claim that Allah appeared to him in the middle of the night, and he told him to go out, and it's a new faith, and this is it. The historians say he was in the middle of an epileptic fit at the time, but that's besides the point. And this is where religion starts, private revelation. And you know something? They're so foolish about it. Because in this parsha, this Shabbos we just read, that when Moshe Rabbeinu was told to come to the Jewish people and say that God appeared to me privately, you know what Moshe Rabbeinu answered? Hein lo yaminu li. They're not going to believe me. So here's the information. This is not believable. You could say whatever you want about a private revelation. People either believe you or they don't. And if they choose not to, there's nothing you can do to prove it. However, the advantage of private revelation to the charlatan is nobody can disprove it. I say, God appeared to me on my way in here. I walked into the building and I had this vision. He kept calm and now start this new religion with all the people here. You can't disprove it. You think probably a little bit, but you can't disprove it. Now, a claim of public revelation can't get away with it unless it really happens. Even a group such as this, take another 100,000 or 200,000 or 1 million or 2 million or 3 million people, and there was probably more according to the calculations that the Torah itself makes, and come up with this claim. You people, millions of eyewitnesses, witnessed these events. You saw the miracles of Mitzrayim. You saw them going through the Yam Suf. You heard the voice of Hashem in Har Sinai. You overheard him speaking directly to Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Torah tells us, doesn't tell us what we believe to be true. It tells it to us in the first person. We witnessed, or it tells it actually, you witnessed, and they passed this. The Torah says many times to the Jewish people, to the first generation, you witnessed God speaking, you witnessed what happened in Egypt, you witnessed all the miracles, you heard what happened at Har Sinai. Don't forget what you heard at Har Sinai. And we take that document and pass it on to our children. That means we testify to our children that we witnessed. Millions of Jewish people testify to their children that they witnessed these events, and this testimony was passed down from generation to generation, not just in a written testimony, not just in the identical written testimony. By the way, you know, the New Testament, which is much younger and smaller than our Tanakh, I believe that they have a calculation that there are 400,000 different variations in text. Over the years, that's, you know, that creeped in. It says, in our Tanakh, in our Torah, we have one, and the one is an insignificant, I think 400,000 of them in the New Testament actually changed the meaning of the story. And we have one difference in Tzu'adaka, whether it's spelled with a hey or an aleph, it's pronounced the same way, it means the same thing, and that's all there is to it. Over thousands of years, passed down from generation to generation. You know how the Torah stays the same. You ever hear the Baal Torah make a mistake? You know what they do to them? They'll kill him. Boo! They're ready to stone him. All he did is he read a little word wrong. He didn't even, it's not written wrong. He wrote it, read it wrong. If it's written wrong, they take the Torah and they put it back. They correct it. And we have, why didn't any nation ever make such a claim? The claim of public miracles does not exist. If you study the religions of the world, you'll find that their claims to public miracles are all due and payable in the next world. Because over there you can say whatever you want. You know. And there's no claim to public revelation. Why? Because you can't get away with those claims. So our claim is the source and the responsible factor and cause of our ability to find happiness in this world. Because we have directives. We have a guidebook. We have the directions from the Creator Himself telling us the purpose for which He created us, giving us our true purpose in life. When I read His directives, I know that my goal is not to raise $4 million to save the Delaware Valley from its cockroaches. That's not a tachlis. But I know what my tachlis is. I have a true purpose. I have this sense of what I'm put on this world for. And I can truly, in that context, find happiness. So I think if we want to convey the ability to be happy to our children, there are a number of things that we have to do. Number one, we have to model that happiness ourselves. I'll never forget one young man in Valley Torah in California many, many years ago told me, he says, the reason I'm religious is because I saw you so happy, even in the face of difficulties that you were going through. Now, by the way, that's not enough. I'm not sure this guy's so religious today, so that's not enough. But it's a good beginning. At least if we exhibit, if we model happiness in our own lives, happiness in our own Jewish lives, happiness in our own family lives, we give our kids some inspiration and some sense and some role model that, hey, you can be happy. Let's look for it. It looks good. It feels good. It makes a lot of sense. How do I find it? Where do I get it from? But it has to go much further than that. It requires that we understand and we can articulate and share with our children the clarity of the distinction between pleasure and happiness. Pleasure, in a sense, is a poor substitute for happiness. Pleasure, in a sense, is a cause of unhappiness because of the frustration and the emptiness that it leaves us with. And the more pleasure we have, and the faster the pace, and the faster the clip, and the more we get it all done, the more we realize that we got nothing. You know, the best part of pleasure is you always dream that the next one, which is going to be a little bit more, that's the one that's going to make you happy. It's just more of the same. More of the same never does it for us. So we have to let our kids know they don't understand the distinction between pleasure and happiness. If you'll give them a test, 50, 60% of them will still say that happiness has to do with having constant pleasure. Happiness has to do with not having constant pleasure more than it has to do with having constant pleasure. And then we have to give them a sense of appreciation of their Judaism. They have to know what a privilege we have. They have to know that we are privileged. We are the only nation in all of history that has ever staked the claim and validates it and defends it and verifies it constantly, that the Creator Himself has given us directly the word, the guidebook, the instruction.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.